breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. Today is Friday, February 3rd, 2017, and we're going to start the show off with a little bit of nonviolence in the news because there's a lot happening in our world of nonviolence right now. Not all of it is being told in the mass media. A lot of it's on social media. So we'll be talking with Monica Kurka, who's a peace builder and community organizer, founder and director of The Beautiful Resistance. And she's been at the Los Angeles airport, LAX, and she's going to be talking a little bit about some of the stories and what's happening, what happened at LAX and what's still happening. And then we'll also talk with Michael Negler about other news and events and views and of how nonviolence is working in our world. This is a very important time. And then in the second half of the show, we'll be looking at the idea of strategy, especially from the viewpoint of one nonviolent strategist, George Lakey, who we had the opportunity to interview a few days ago for our film in nonviolence. So first of all, let me bring on our show, Monica Kurka. Welcome, Monica, to Nonviolence Radio.
Thank you very much.
So, Monica, you're a peace builder, community organizer, and the founder of The Beautiful Resistance, which convenes individuals and communities to transform conflict, provide training and workshops on nonviolence and transformative leadership, and also leads narrative-shifting campaigns and movements locally and internationally. Can you talk about, get us started with The Beautiful Resistance so people know where you're coming from as somebody who has studied conflict and coexistence at Brandeis, and this is something that you're very passionate about. So what is The Beautiful Resistance, and how did that bring you to LAX?
Right. So I have been working for various nonprofits and doing narrative shift, doing similar work. I found that when I work for peace-building organizations or when I work for social justice, the work was different. In peace-building, it was about maybe having common ground or that we're somehow neutral. We can come neutral.
Monica, your phone is cutting out a little bit. Can you try to move in your room?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great.
How's that? So there's very little analysis of power dynamics in peace-building spaces, in my experience. It was more about coming in as a neutral party. And in organizing spaces, it was very much about power dynamics and almost a binary thinking, us versus them. And so I felt like these two practices should be combined and can be powerful force in how we really confront the issues that we're facing today, right, in America and internationally. And so the Beautiful Resistance started with that, where we're 100% peace builders, but we look at our work more like decolonizing peace building. We understand that we come from a certain perspective. There is no such thing as neutrality, but our end goal is transformation, not winning. And so that's a difference, I would say, than in some of the work I've been involved in. But we're definitely in the realm of community organizing and activism. But we you know, in the Kingian nonviolent way, you know, we attack systems, not people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we bring down violent structural violence and violent systems, not human beings that can be transformed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a kind of a different space. So that's where this began. I was doing work with the Arab American Civic Council and other organizations with the Refugees Welcome Project for the last year. And that's where a lot of the work with refugees has come from, was that project that is now under the Beautiful Resistance.
So you were already positioned in a way for what was about to happen a few days ago at LAX. So tell us about when you heard that Trump had signed the executive order, and then what took place, and how did you organize, and how did you get there?
Right. So I was actually facilitating a conference at UCI, University of California, Irvine, a peace-building conference, and we got the news, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, we got the news that there was going to be a leaked document that was a ban against refugees, and then it became much more than Reuters News published it, and it became like a reality. We work with locally here in Southern California, we work with the Refugee Forum of Orange County in Los Angeles, and one of the members is World Relief, which is one of the nine national resettlement agencies for refugees, and we work very closely with them. So seeing as they actually resettle refugees, they asked us to support them in making sure that they would not be detained, their refugees would not be detained. So they asked us to lead on some advocacy, because their work is really about welcoming refugees and providing housing and providing community to support them. So it's really on the humanitarian aid side. The advocacy is just as important. That's not their wheelhouse, so they called upon the Refugees Welcome Project to do that. And through the Beautiful Resistance, we did that. So what we did was we connected with a lot of partners first in Orange County, where we mostly organize. And first we had a press conference on Friday morning. Thursday morning we had a press conference with Muslim organizations like CARE, the Arab American Civic Council, which is more interfaith, but also we had immigrant rights organizations that were working on with undocumented community, and then we had refugee organizations like World Relief. I myself am a refugee from Romania, and so I come at this more as my own liberation rather than doing I would call it like charity work. I'm looking at this as a recovering refugee. Mm-hmm. And doing this work for my own people, too. And so when we did the press conference, we really started to be able to create a narrative around this. What does it mean to not be that these people do not belong in our country? And so after the press conference, we started mobilizing. There was a town hall that a local congressman was holding. We mobilized there and did a march just around that. And you know, this is so new that we didn't have, like, the words yet, right? When it comes, you're just kind of, wow, what's going on? It hadn't been in place. That was Friday. It had not been in place yet. And then Saturday, we started hearing news of people being detained. People from other countries, not even the seven banned countries, were being detained, were being returned. We know that now the famous case of the man from Iran, that was a legal resident that was detained. So Sunday, we all went out. Some good friends of mine that are from an organization called Vigilant Love, I organized with them. They led a huge rally at LAX, but about 7,000 people came out at, from different rallies at LAX on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Completely beautiful resistance. There was so many people and so many voices, and it was really united that refugees are welcomed here. Undocumented are welcomed here. No to deportation. Well, Muslims are welcomed here. So the narrative became very, very specific. And then World Relief asked a specific ask for us to go on Tuesday. There was a family from Afghanistan. They're special immigrant visa holders that they're called SIVs. Mm-hmm. And SIVs have worked with the U.S. government in Afghanistan or Iraq. So those are the two countries that are granted SIV status. Congress approved that a few years back. That means when they land in the U.S., they are legal residents of the United States of America. They automatically get green cards, and they're able to live, work, do everything.
Okay.
It's in a way, they're almost like our veterans, right? They assisted our veterans. And so we had already had some problems with people that were not on the list being detained. So we went into action and we did a rally in front of the Tom Bradley terminal. And we basically started around 12 and went all the way till midnight. The family was finally released around 9:30 at night. Then there was also other families being detained. So the family of four children and parents, this case was different. Most of the SIVs maybe were translators. This case, the father was a mechanic. And so he wasn't as educated or spoke English as well as other SIVs. So really, like, advocating for himself, wasn't, you know, knowing his own rights, wasn't, and speaking English, right? So those key things that maybe would help some detainees. But thank goodness they were released. The problems at LAX was happening is that they're actually, again, going against the court order not to hold people.
Wow.
So they're actually breaking the law. They're not allowing detainees to have legal counsel, even though there was more than 20 lawyers. I would say about five that speak Dari that were there present, and translators. So people could have come to that family to support them and to help them. Mm-hmm. But CPB, the Customs Border Patrol, were not allowing anybody. They're not answering calls. They're very contained. They're not sharing information. We don't know how many people are detained. We don't know how long they're detained. All we know is when families come and say, "I'm waiting for my family member," that's all we know. And then we can go into action. I could tell you specifics about what we did and some stories from there if you'd like.
Sure. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and we're in our portion of Nonviolence in the News, and we have the special opportunity to speak with Monica Kurka, who's a peace builder and community organizer with an organization that she helped to co-found, or the founder of, The Beautiful Resistance, which you can find online, especially on social media. Yes, Monica, do tell us some of the stories, because it is important that we put human face on the people who are being detained by our government.
Right. So so this family was not from the seven ban list, and yet they were detained. Normally 3 hours is normal detention, not detention, but, you know, secondary screening, let's call it. Mm-hmm. 9 hours, definitely not normal. Mm-hmm. Definitely not normal. And this is what, you know, this is what resettlement agencies do. They go there once a week to pick up somebody. So they know what's normal, what's not normal. The family came out and they told us that the officer of the CPB questioned them, separated them, and basically told the father, they're going to call the Kabul embassy, and if nobody answers, they're going to get deported.
Wow.
So threatening deportation of a legal resident of the United States, which, you know, is just torture. I mean, there's no other word for it. There's no need for that. Mm. Even though his paperwork is there, and people, the director of World Relief, the lawyers, everybody was present, they did not want to meet with us. So that was one story. There was a man that on our page, on the Beautiful Resistance Facebook page, you could see his story. We did a video with him. There was a man from Syria, and his son had a kidney transplant in Cleveland, at the Cleveland Clinic. And this man from Syria lives and works in Dubai. And he just happened to come last week to visit his family. His son just had the surgery. And then this ban came into place. So this gentleman, he left Syria. He left the war. He went to Dubai. He works there. You know, he has a car there in the parking lot, and you know, in the garage. He has a home. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want anything from any American. He doesn't want anything. And now with this ban, basically his choice is go back to Dubai and work to support his family and not lose his job. But he will he'll probably not be able to see his family for another year. His son has to be in the hospital for another year to not, he can't be moving because of this surgery. So now he has a choice to either separate from his family and go and work or stay here, maybe probably lose his job, lose his home, lose their whole life there. And this is a ban. So this is not even a refugee. This is just an immigrant that came legally here with the immigrant visa. With a tourist visa to help his son, and so this is not a terrorist. This is not anybody linked. It's just a family man that now is stuck. So he was in LA visiting a friend that was hopefully going to help them, and he came out to the protest and he made a sign, and his sign said, "We're Syrians. We love people. We're normal people." Here we go.
Yeah.
He said, "I am a Syrian. We are not bad people, like what Mr. Trump said. We like everyone else have blood and breath.
We love everybody." And he just held that sign for the 10 hours we were there. And so that was amazing. Another time we went around in a circle, and this is maybe what's different with the Beautiful Resistance, is really bringing in the personal transformation into the outer revolution. So we actually stopped the chanting, and we went around in a circle, and I facilitated a circle where everybody said why they're there, brings them there, what's their story. And we went around, and when we were almost done, there was a gentleman, and he had a suitcase there. And we were like, oh, I guess you just landed. And he's like, yeah, I just came from Sudan. I was detained for 10 hours. He said, this is the most important thing I could do right now, is to stand with you guys. He made a sign. And he just stood with us. Basically, he just stood with us for a few hours and stood there and was also protesting. What is a good way to understand what's happening is the protests at the airports are actually direct action. This is not a protest the way you might go on a prayer vigil or a march around your city. This is a targeted direct action. So our presence at the airport are getting media attention, which brought the attorneys there. Okay, so now ACLU has a vested interest in seeing this happen. So the media comes, the attorneys are present to be legal observers and also to assist the families if the Customs and Border Patrol would actually allow them. And then the case managers, the refugee resettlement agencies, they're there to wait for the family. And so without the public pressure, without the pressure of the protesters, and this is what Glenn Peterson, the director of World Relief, came actually out to say thank you to everybody. Because without that pressure, the CPB would actually not feel pressure to release people. There's no accountability. And without the lawyers there, there would be no legal observer there to say, hey, we're here, we're watching what you're doing. We heard from this guy that just walked out that there's 10 people there. So it's really important that people go out to the airports and protest. And this is not just a cathartic experience. This is actually helping. This is actually releasing people from detention, like right now. And so what we've tried to do is, the many, many people have tried to, is create a constant presence at LAX. There was another story where we were chanting, and I was inside. I was going, between the lawyers and between the case managers for the resettlement agencies and between the protesters and just kind of checking in on everybody. And one of the times when I was with the lawyers and the case managers, this Iraqi family came out, an older couple, permanent residents. They had been here for many years. They had been here 10 years. Their son had been waiting for them. I don't know how many hours. We were talking to him for an hour. But they had been waiting for him. He had been waiting for them. They finally came out, the father and mother, maybe in their 60s, and they came out to huge crowd saying, welcome refugees, welcome Muslims, welcome Iraqis. And they were weeping. They were weeping and waving. And so to think also that this is actually a verbal expression of our welcome, that when they come, they've just been detained, they've been threatened with deportation, they've been threatened with who knows what else. And then they come and there's people to welcome them. We had food for them. People were hugging them. People were welcoming them, all kinds of signs that welcome them. It was just such a beautiful expression of Americans, but also of who we are as people, like the humanity. And so that was really a beautiful moment. We had another lady from Saudi Arabia who just walked out and like her family, and she was just like in awe of what's happening. So I stopped her. I said, hey, where are you from? And she said, I'm from Saudi Arabia. And I said, what do you think about this? And she said, this is great. I was so afraid, but then I saw you all. Now I feel okay.
Wow, so, those are very, yeah, very powerful stories. And I appreciate the way that you've contextualized what's happening for our listeners in the tradition of nonviolent direct action with the emphasis on your work and the Beautiful Resistance. Monica Kurka, can you tell people how they can get involved before we shift over to our other segment of this news program today?
Sure. I think, if you are not able to get out to an airport, I would call your local congressman. They have relationships with Customs and Border Patrol, ask them to call. Tell them this family is detained, or there are people, I know that there's this many people detained, or I want those that are detained to be released. Then you can also get the number of CPB. They're not answering calls usually, but we can jam up their lines and ask them. So that's one thing. Social media is another way to get the word out. A lot of the cities, if you do some searches about events, you can find if there's a march or if there's a protest at your airport, and maybe you could just even share it, the live feed. But you can also go out to your airport and just welcome. I mean, that is an act of resistance, just welcoming those that are not accepted in our community. So, yeah, I think those are amazing ways to act wherever you are in the United States to be able to act in a form of resistance, in a nonviolent form of resistance. You can look us up at the Beautiful Resistance. We are located in Southern California, but we can probably put you in touch with others around the country that are doing similar work if you don't know where else to look.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Monica Kurka, for joining us today on Nonviolence Radio, and we hope to have you back another time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Michael Negler, my co-host and news anchor, has some resources in other parts of this bigger picture of nonviolence in the news. And that was a great look at what was happening at the airport work at LAX in particular, but it's happening all over the country. So what other kind of news do you have in the world of nonviolence for us, Michael?
Stephanie, I have a lot, but I just wanted to say that was a very passionate segment for me because on my mother's side, my grandparents are Romanian and could as well be called refugees. They came here to escape persecutions of various kinds in Romania back in the last century. And I was very pleased that she talked about targeted direct action and the difference between that and protest, because that's something that a lot of people who are in the know about what makes nonviolence really work are talking about just now.
Right. And I hope we get to that on the next part of our show, on the second segment in about 10 minutes or so. So what kind of resources do you have for us for our news hour?
Yeah. First of all, there's a new book by Eileen Markey, and it's called Love in Action, The Life, Work, and Death of Sister Maura Clark. Sister Maura was one of the four U.S. nuns who were murdered in El Salvador by the U.S.-financed Salvadoran military, and that book has gotten a lot of really good reviews. Now, most of the resources that have come my way and that I wanted to talk about are actually along the line of how people can act more effectively and how we can make the big shift from a one-off action, a protest, to a sustained, effective movement. I'll just mention one now that Ryan Resnick has listed four tips for action. Make your message as salient as possible. Two, unite overlapping protest concerns under one banner. Three, pivot from talk to action. That's the one we've been talking about. And four, don't just be reactive. We need to be proactive. And I think that is perhaps the most important message that we can share right now. And finally, by way of a resource, I'd like to mention that there is something called the Groundswell Movement. And about 2 weeks ago, they filmed a conference of the National Moral Revival Poor People's Campaign. And they filmed, and it is now available, both as a hashtag Revolutionary Love and on the Groundswell Movement website. There is an extremely passionate talk by one Valerie Kaur, K-A-U-R, who is a third-generation Sikh refugee, and the theme of her talk was, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? Mm. In other words, a resource from which new life will spring. And I just can't recommend that video strongly enough. So then moving on to the news, as I say, we will get back to some of these resources about tips and stuff. But getting on to the news, there is a Washington Post report, which I think is really remarkable, that 180 federal employees have signed up for a workshop featuring expert advice on workers' rights and civil disobedience. This, to me, is brand new, and it relates to one of the important concepts that Gene Sharp made famous, and that is the concept of, quote, pillars of support. That is, when there is an authoritarian figure or group of figures, they cannot operate alone. They have police, they have military, and they often have governmental agencies in their pocket. And so one of the things that you want to do, one of the things that you must do to accomplish regime change is to weaken those pillars of support. You saw this very dramatically in Serbia in the year 2000 when the Otpor resistance descended on Belgrade, on the parliament building. The police mustered out to stop them and simply laid down their weapons and went back inside. In fact, there was a tense moment there when people started getting abusive toward the police, and one old gentleman got up and said, no, 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 they are going to join us. So once that happens, then the authoritarian regime has no power anymore. So this, I think this is a very hopeful sign happening very early in our struggle that these federal employees are studying civil disobedience. That's quite remarkable when you have government employees studying how to be disobedient in government. Seattle, last week on Wednesday, they have a committee called Affordable Housing Neighborhoods and Finance Committee. And they had a unanimous vote to forward a bill to pull $3 billion from Wells Fargo. Because as we know, Wells Fargo is one of the main sources of support for the Dakota Access Pipeline. And that bill now goes to the full city council. And it follows an announcement on the day before that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is intending to issue an easement allowing DAPL to begin the last stages of construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And as usual, the protectors of Standing Rock are challenging this legally and with their bodies. There were 70 arrests last week. Things are getting very tense now under the new administration. But I haven't seen a single voice saying, well, now we give up. Not only that, but people all over the country, not only the indigenous water protectors at Standing Rock, are promising sustained resistance. But the Keystone XL pipeline is being faced by native water protectors in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, and they are also vowing to be in it for the long haul. That kind of persistence you may remember from the Central American struggles. It's called firmeza permanente, permanent firmness. And this is one of the inalienable weapons of nonviolent resistance. I've often said that determination and persistence are our answer to their ruthlessness. So moving on now to my hometown, Brooklyn, New York. Last week, there 1,000 shops, bodegas and groceries and businesses, which happen to be owned by Yemenis, are shut down from noon to 8 to protest the administration and its Muslim ban. A quote from a spokesperson, this shutdown of grocery stores and bodegas will be a public show of the vital role these grocers and their families play in New York's economic and social fabric, which, being a Brooklynite, I can absolutely attest to. And after the shutdown, they will gather at Borough Hall for a call and a prayer and a rally. So taking a glance around the rest of the world, in the heart of the Amazon basin, there is a Tapajos River basin, which is also at the heart of an exploding controversy. whether to build more than 40 large dams or railway, roads, canals, port complexes, and turn the basin into a vast industrialized commodities export corridor, or to curb this development impulse and conserve one of the most biologically and culturally rich regions on the planet. And those who are struggling to shape the fate of this region do hold conflicting opinions. But because Tapajós is an isolated region, few of these views are getting aired in the media. So I am very happy to be able to bring it to your attention on Nonviolence Radio. Now, moving on to Iraq, we have long been in contact with a group called Un Ponte Per, which is based in Italy. And the leader is a woman by the name of Martina Pignatti, whom we have spoken with. And they are supporters of a group called Iraqi Civil Society, ICSCI, Iraqi Civil Society Solidarity Initiative. Mm-hmm. Big mouthful, but that's who they are. And Martina has recently stated that we as global civil society denounce the business and vested interests behind a lot of the corruption in Iraq. And the best way to fight this military-industrial complex is to prove that peace-building measures are effective in transforming conflicts, and nonviolent struggle is the only way to build sustainable change. It's really quite remarkable. They are actually advocating nonviolent resistance as opposed to the military response to ISIS, to Daesh. And I have become to feeling all along that if we come out of this crisis with a robust, sophisticated, reasonably well-coordinated, I don't want to say well-organized in the sense that there'll be one central umbrella organization. That's not necessary, and it's not the style anymore. And I'm going to be talking about something along those lines very soon. But if we can come out with that kind of robust, ready resistance, then I think we will have a safe America. Because as Gandhi said and Thoreau said, democracy works only when you have the ability to carry out civil resistance when it is abused. So what we're seeing now under this extreme circumstance with all of the violence in Iraq might be a model for what has to happen here. So they are taking concrete action with towards another Iraq with peace and human rights for all. In fact, let me read their mission statement. They're dedicated to bringing together Iraqi and international civil societies through concrete actions to build together another Iraq with peace and human rights for all. Now, a brief notice of events. In February 22nd and 23rd, Meta will be first sponsoring Ali Abu Awad, who is a remarkable Palestinian nonviolent activist, remarkable both in his commitment to principled nonviolence and his effectiveness. And the following day, we'll be having a bit of a fundraiser in Petaluma. So stay tuned for more about those events in our next episodes.
You're listening to Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and we just finished our segment on nonviolence in the news. There's plenty going around about what nonviolence is and how to get active with this great power. But first of all, let's take a moment, and we should do this every show, to define nonviolence. And I want to invite my co-host and author of the Nonviolence Handbook in a few short words to tell us what does nonviolence mean to you?
Oh, just that, Stephanie. Yeah, happy to do it. I like to think of nonviolence as a power. And in fact, in our forthcoming film, we interviewed Dr. Bernard Lafayette, and that's the first thing he says. Nonviolence for me is a form of power, and that power is in every human being. And I would add that power comes from the conversion of a negative force like fear or anger into its corresponding positive type.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Michael. So nonviolence is a kind of power that's inside of us, and it can be developed and harnessed and used for positive ends. And there are people who have been working on nonviolence in this, in our current generation and in Michael's generation as well, for a very long time. And one of these people is George Lakey, co-founder of the Earthquaker Action Group. And he's currently on book tour for a very visionary new book called Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. And he helped create a very important training manual with Training for Change. And he's just one of the foremost scholars in nonviolence and strategists, how to bring people together. One of his recent articles on waging nonviolence went viral. It was seen by and shared by over 10,000 people in a very short amount of time, urging people to think strategically beyond these one-off protests and one-off marches. How do we bring people together? He offers 10 points of that. And then another famous nonviolent direct action strategist, David Solnit, brother of the Rebecca Solnit, also interviewed George Lakey, and they wrote something up for Common Dreams, going a little bit deeper into George Lakey's piece. We had the opportunity at the Meta Center and then on Nonviolence Radio to interview George Lakey at the home of our filmmaker friend Lou Zwire, because the Meta Center is currently working on a documentary film on nonviolence, the full spectrum of it. So when George was coming through town, we grabbed him for Nonviolence Radio. And we're going to play a little bit of that interview between Lou Zwire, who's recording him for Nonviolence Radio and for the nonviolence film. And we want to comment a little bit on what he's saying. So let's hear from what George has to say here.
I was brought up to be practical. How do we get things done? And so in college, I was very concerned. Actually, since age 12, I was very concerned about racial equality. I preached a sermon, actually, in my small town's church about it being God's will that there be racial equality. At age 12, I preached that sermon. That was the end of my preaching career. I got the distinct message. They didn't want any more of that. And it stayed on my mind. And then in college, I got to think more about that kind of thing and wonder, what is it, what is it that can really move the needle? Because things seemed very stuck. And at the same time, I was reviewing the Gospels in the Bible, and seeing for the first time that Jesus wanted us to turn the other cheek. The first time that phrase, which I knew, actually meant anything to me. And I thought, well, I was brought up to be pro-military, so what about that? So that spun me into a year's pretty intense search and research and questioning, out of which came a pacifist commitment, a very strong pacifist commitment. But still with this very strong social justice, racial justice, economic justice kind of orientation. So, well, how do you be a pacifist and also work for real change? And at that time, the Montgomery bus boycott was going on. And Ralph Abernathy came to my town, my college town, and gave a talk about what they were doing down there. And it was just such an opening. You know, I wanted to be practical. Just taking a moral stand was not enough at all. And so here was a very practical movement going on, a campaign that I could learn from. And it's been pretty straightforward ever since, in a way.
What motivated you to give the sermon on was it equality, you said?
Yeah, racial equality. I prayed on it. I just prayed on it, you know, asking God what. I'd been given the pulpit by the elders of the church, who thought I might have the makings of a boy preacher because there was that kind of thing going on in my denomination. And of course, it was hugely flattering for me. Oh my gosh, maybe I'll be a boy preacher. So, but of course, I had to turn to God to ask for the topic of the sermon, and that's the topic I was given.
Was there a moment when you felt that you learned that nonviolence was an effective tool?
Well, for one thing, that Ralph Abernathy, you know, speech outlining in a more personal way what the Montgomery Black people were doing, but also in the course of that research I was doing about pacifism, because I didn't really want to be a pacifist. I didn't want the alienation from my family that I thought would result. I kept being very skeptical, and I read everything I could. I even read a Marxist book, The Case Against Pacifism, not because I was Marxist, but because I was looking for evidence for why pacifism was crazy. And at the same time, I was looking at history, and I was by that time attending Quaker meeting. And so I was looking at Quaker history also. And I got to thinking, what about those early friends who came to Pennsylvania and, you know, the colonies, and what kinds of conversations might they have been having with their neighbors? You know, with the neighbors saying, well, you're going to go be over there with savages. Of course, you're going to take a gun to protect your family, right? And the Quaker farmer saying, no, we're not going to do that. And okay, well, you can have these principles for yourself, but you're not going to expose your family to risk. Surely you're not going to do that. I mean, the principle is one thing, but we do have to protect our family. We're men, right? And the Quaker farmer, this was all made up in my head, the Quaker farmer responding, no, we think we'll actually be safer as well as doing the right thing by going over there without guns. And then it turned out the Quakers were the safest people in the American frontier. A moment, right? And that's what I found over and over with the Montgomery boycott, time after time after time. It's not that nonviolence is some kind of instant solution or even a long drawn out but guaranteed success kind of thing. But I was practical enough to realize there's no such thing as guarantees. And nevertheless, the fact that nonviolent action turned out to be so practical in so many situations that I was encountering even then led me to think, well, since in the beginning of any action or any response, okay, you attack me right now, in the beginning of that, I have no way of actually knowing how things will turn out. It's the nature of our human condition. We can't actually know for sure, right? So I could conceivably, let's say I have options. I could take a violent option or I could take a nonviolent option. But either way, I still don't know how it's going to turn out, right? So what do I know existentially in that moment? What I know is the character of the means I'm using. I don't know the end, but I do know the means I'm choosing. And that knowledge gives me a responsibility to choose in an integrity, choose in a way that's integrous for me. And so choosing the nonviolent means, still not knowing how it's going to turn out, nevertheless, it provides for me a solid ground for choice. And that's been true for me in street encounters, attacks of various kinds. Twice a knife has been pulled on me and so on. And I've been in war zones, and I always feel confident that I'm making a choice on the basis of solid ground, even though the nature of the human condition is we can never really know what the consequences will be.
You're listening to George Lakey on Nonviolence Radio, and we got to interview George for our film on nonviolence, and you're hearing Lou's Wire interview him, and Lou is now asking him to tell that knife story that he just spoke of in the interview, so let's bring him back up.
That are nonviolent stories. And so if that's one of them you would like to tell, that would be great.
I have better ones.
Do you?
Better ones in the sense of more widely applicable for others, if that would be.
Yeah, thinking about who the audience is, might be a good story for them to hear about, you know, because I'm guessing our audience is maybe skeptical, a little skeptical about people that don't know anything about it, be skeptical about whether it works at all and whether it's something other than passivity.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are in working for social change, they may think that, yes, nonviolence is a good thing, but, you know, it doesn't work in some situations. It just doesn't work. There's no time for it, or there's no whatever. I'm not sure. What story do you think would be good for them to hear?
Actually, I just thought of a third knife encounter that would be better than the first two that I thought of, and more widely applicable, maybe. I think, yeah, actually, in the situation we're coming up in the next 4 to 8 years, it is more applicable, I think.
Okay,
so I'll tell that.
Okay, go ahead.
So there we were, a whole bunch of people speaking out against the war in Vietnam, and the method we used was to put a milk crate out on the street and take turns standing on the crate and speaking out. So it was good assertiveness practice for us and learning to articulate our position and so on. And we were gathering a crowd every time we did it because the Vietnam War was hot and there was a lot of controversy about it. So I noticed this guy looking extremely stern and actually angry. And I couldn't tell if it was a uniform or a quasi-uniform that he was wearing. But anyway, he did stand out as the most threatening character in the thing as I was standing on the box. And then when I finished up, I got down and I headed in sort of gradually, not in a threatening way, but just kind of meandered in his direction. But he came to me and he pulled out a knife because he said, I'm just out of Vietnam. I'm just on furlough. And there you are betraying me and betraying our soldiers, and I'm not going to let you do that. And I just stared him in the eye, and I said, the thing is, I don't think you want to live with the consequences of doing this. You can do it, but I don't think you want to live with that. And I just kept staring at him. And he said, you're right. And he put the knife away. And we were close enough in together that even though we were surrounded by a crowd, nobody else noticed. So he was able to, withdraw gracefully. Actually, he hung around for a little while longer before he withdrew. So I think what my various experiences with violence have been is that experiencing a lot of ambivalence on the part of the attacker. And I think that's one of the easy things for us to forget when we feel scared. Of course, I felt scared. It's only natural to feel scared. But one of the things that can go with fear is forgetting the rest of reality. It's just like, and one of the things that's helpful to remember, I think, for a nonviolent practitioner, is to remember that even when people come at you looking very determined to do harm, there's an ambivalence. And actually, I think that goes with the human condition. And so if you can remember that and then speak to that part of them that is kind of wondering, is this smart what I'm doing? Then that gives you much more of an edge in terms of getting on with your life.
Okay. So you've already talked some about what is nonviolence. So that's one of our questions, is what is nonviolence? Mm-hmm. And you've already talked some about that. Is there any more you want to say about what nonviolence is for people who, aren't really sure what it is?
One of the things I like about nonviolence as a technique of struggle is that it's very accessible for people who aren't much in touch with their inner life. They can just do it, it's practical, or our leader says do it now, so we'll do it now and complain later, or whatever is the circumstance. And it's also a technique of struggle that is very friendly to having an inner life. And one may not have a leader who is like Dr. King or someone, or Gandhi, or someone who's emphasizing the inner life, but one can be the only one in a crowd of people practicing nonviolent action and still carry that inner life, carry the awareness of that and the practice of that, whatever that practice happens to be, if it's a kind of prayer, kind of ritual, kind of breathing, whatever it is that one does. And I love the technique that supports that. And I think that's another distinction between nonviolent action and violent action, because in my conversation with soldiers, they don't tell me that they do have much opportunity to be in touch with their souls at the same time as they're doing their violent thing. So I think we really, that's yet another advantage of nonviolent action.
For those of you just tuning in who were listening to this interview. That was George Lakey, a very well-known nonviolent strategist and author. He just wrote Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. And here on Nonviolence Radio, we had the opportunity to interview him both for our radio show and for a film that the Meta Center for Nonviolence is doing on nonviolence called The Journey Home. And so let's talk, Michael, and myself, my co-host, for just a little bit to talk about what George Lakey was just saying, and especially if we can address in any way some of the 10 points that he does bring up in his now viral piece from Waging Nonviolence about a 10-point plan to stop Trump and make gains in justice and equality, which is a piece about not so much about Trump but as a politician, but about how nonviolence works in our political sphere. So, Michael, these 10 points, which people can go and read on the web, we don't need to recite them to them, but the one main point was for movements to find themselves in the try to use defense in a way that they get on the offensive instead of the defensive. Can you say anything about that and what else you think that you might like to add to George's piece in just a couple minutes?
Yeah, Stephanie, what I would tie into, first of all, and what George was just saying, is so many really important points.
Right.
But I really liked what he said about allowing the attacker to withdraw gracefully. And I'm sure it reminded you of the same quote that it reminded me of, which is a quote by Toynbee, the British historian Arnold Toynbee, who said of Gandhi, "He made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to withdraw without rancor and without humiliation." And this is something that we often forget, but it's strategically so important to give your opponent a graceful way to back out, because they're experiencing, whether it seems that way or not, they're experiencing that ambivalence that George was talking about. And George goes on to say in that interview that nonviolence is a wonderful way to be a human being. Because a human being cannot be vicious, cannot be aggressive, cannot be hurtful without feeling some hurt and alienation within themselves. So if you know about that, if you honor it, and if you work with it, it gives you a great deal of strategic power.
So how can we, I like this point that you make, how can we bring people along in any point of our lives to help them to back out of a position that we are in or they are in gracefully? And what does that look like when you are in such disagreement about what's being done or being said or is being represented by you because it's your own government? What would be one example? Just to add to that, a little bit later in the interview, Lakey did say that one very powerful thing that Gandhi said was that the British are worthy opponents. They are our worthy opponent, meaning that it's bringing out really the best in who we are because it's testing every part of us. It's building, making us grow closer together. It's showing in the light what needs to change. And they have dignity. They also have dignity. And how can those who are involved in nonviolent struggle on whatever side they are politically or not at all see their opponents not as a dehumanized thing, but as a really worthy human being and opponent? And I think that it's maybe that's not a question we can answer on this show. Oh, Michael, you can. Yeah. Sure. Can you do it in 30 seconds, though?
I shall try. It reminds me very much of something that took place that Martin Luther King describes in Stride Toward Freedom, where they had almost got the city council to agree to their demands. When one of the white city council members said, "If we do this, the Negroes will say that they have won, and that we cannot allow." Mm. Now, I think the key to having that kind of conversation with an opponent is to move it out of the arena of winning and losing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And relocate it as a learning process that you're going in together.
Great. Okay, well, there's so much more that we could say. This is the work that we've dedicated our lives to. This is Nonviolence. This is Nonviolence Radio. So we look forward to coming back on our show in 2 weeks with Cynthia Boas, professor of political science and at Cidade
Sonoma State.
Sonoma State. And also to follow up a little bit more with some nonviolence in the news, we want to thank our guests today, Monica Kurka and also George Lakey, for allowing himself to be interviewed for our film and for Nonviolence Radio, to our mother station, KWMR, to all community radio. I hope that more people tune into community radio and support it. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another. Bye.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. Some real estate here in my bag, so we bought a pack of cigarettes, and this is where the pies, and walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said as we boarded the Greyhound. Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. Last 1 hour ago, so I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. Don't